Nausea. It is by one of my favorite bands of all time, X. If you haven't checked them out, I strongly recommend you do. Please don't get nausea through the first 60 minutes of the show. Actually, it only lasts 60 minutes. Don't get nausea. My name is John McAdam, and I am here with my great co-host, Sean Goodwin. Sean, how are you?
Great, John. How are you?
I'm doing really good because I am about to roll with the only Wicked Good podcast on the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. Give us 60 minutes, and we will give you a Wicked Good podcast, and I am excited about today.
Yeah, can
Let
we
me
start?
Say something real... I'm sorry?
I said, yeah, can we start?
No. Well, you know what? I do want to start. I do want to mention something. Frank Robinson passed away today, and we're not sticking to wrestling. Frank was an all-time great baseball player who had the misfortune of playing at the same time as, like, Mays, Mantle, and Aaron. But, I mean, go to his baseball reference page if you're a casual baseball fan to check out how great he was. First black manager in Major League history, RIP Frank.
First man to win the MVP in both leagues.
Is he still the only?
He might be the only. I just covered myself by saying the first. I'm sure of that.
I can't think of anyone, but hey, if there's someone else, go to our Facebook page. It's Stick to Wrestling on Facebook. It's easy to find. If you are not already a member, we invite you to join. Now, in the cheesiest tie-in ever, next week is Valentine's Day. Am I right, John?
Absolutely.
So why not have a show about Johnny Valentine?
And, I could not agree with you more. And more importantly, what better way to celebrate one of the few mythological, almost mythological guys in the business, Johnny Valentine, than having somebody on who's actually seen the great man and Wahoo McDaniel live?
Wahoo McDaniel versus Johnny Valentine. I want to introduce someone who I've been friends with for like over 30 years for sure. Haven't talked to him in a while. He's never been on a podcast, but I am very confident we're going to get a great show out of this guy. I want to introduce Mike Gunter. Mike, how are you?
I'm doing great, John and Sean. Thanks for having me on tonight.
Thank you for taking the time to come on with us. Mike is someone who grew up in the Carolinas, saw Johnny Valentine in the late 60s, in the 70s, and you mentioned that you had seen him in Florida as well.
I saw him in Florida on TV. I actually grew up in Alabama. And I didn't move to North Carolina until 1971, but I did see him on the TV in Florida before I saw him here in the Carolinas.
Okay. That's definitely a start. One other thing I wanted to mention, too, is find me on Twitter. Just put in John McAdam, and I'm the one with Moondog Maine getting hit in the face with the chair. I don't do a lot of talking on Twitter. I'm more of a listener-type guy, but that's what I'm going to be on this show because I am so interested in what Mike has to say. Mike, when was the first time you saw Johnny Valentine?
When I grew up in Alabama. We got cable down there in 1969 in February.
Whoa, wait a minute. You got cable in 69?
Yes. Hey, the town I grew up in was only 5,000 people. It was tiny. But we got cable in our town in February of 1969. And the reason I know that is because the very first show of any kind of wrestling other than Gulf Coast Wrestling, which I was our local promotion that I got on the TV out of Dothan, was Championship Wrestling from Florida, and it was in February of 69 because the very first episode I ever saw was when Gordon Sully played the film clip of Dory Jr. beating Gene Kaniski for the title and doing the interview with Dory. So that's the very first episode I ever saw of anybody other than Gulf Coast Wrestling on TV. So
that's crazy.
Johnny Valentine.
Because I got cable February of 1980, and the first thing I saw that was not WWF wrestling was Bob Armstrong winning the Southeast Heavyweight title from a guy named Sterling Golden.
Right.
We all knew who he grew up to become, but wow, the first thing you saw was the Kaniski title change.
Exactly. I'd never even heard of these. I'd never heard of, you know, the Funks or Kaniski or any of those guys because, like I said, I grew up on Gulf Coast wrestling. And that's all we got where I lived.
I know the feeling because when I first started watching wrestling, all I knew was the WWF. And then one day, one of my friends had a wrestling magazine. And I'm looking through this, and I'm like, you know, who is Terry Funk? Who is Rocky Johnson? Who is Mr. Wrestling 2? And, you know, that opened up another whole new world of wrestling for me.
Right. Mike, let's I still can't believe I'm talking to someone who actually watched these two. The one thing I always hear about Valentine is just the deliberateness, like how slow he would come to the ring, how he would react to the crowd. How,
oh, absolutely.
You know, I remember hearing one guy describe it, saying, you know, he would like put one foot on the step, the crowd would react, and then he would take it down.
Right.
And but I just wanted to tell me what like the entrance was like. For one of his matches,
like you said, he took forever to get from like the dressing room out to the ring, and very deliberate, milking the crowd for every bit it was worth. And I only saw him live in a non-studio one time. I saw him one time for a TV taping, and one time in the Dorton Arena here in Raleigh versus Wahoo. So I never saw him as much as my good friend John Hitchcock saw him, but. He and Wahoo just beat the total crap out of each other. It was just unbelievable how bad they chopped each other. And just, it was probably the closest match I can think of that, as far as violence, was when I saw Dr. Death and Terry Gordy and the Steiners one time. That's probably as close to the violence as the Valentine and Wahoo match. It was just electric.
Johnny was famous for starting all of his matches really – even the match was slow when it started off. I mean, it would take him 20 minutes to warm up, you know, until he got – what were those first 20 minutes like? How could – because most fans will look at something like that and go, today, go, we can't – how was he able to keep that first 20 interesting?
Well, it was a lot of facial expressions, he would – you know, he would milk a headlock for all it was worth and use a lot of emotion on his face and, you know, you could tell, but just by looking at him, he was a real badass, and he, let that go all the way, you know, just the way he acted and the way he would, look at the crowd and have total contempt for his opponent and everything.
He has my favorite line in wrestling. And I the first time I heard it was Roddy Piper. But it was, you could never make them all believe in wrestling, but I sure as hell could make them believe in me.
Exactly. I saw an interview where Piper told that story about hearing that from Valentine in the dressing room. Along with a bunch of ribs, Valentine was known for playing on the other wrestlers in the dressing rooms. He was a notorious rib master, too.
Oh, my understanding was he was rough with the ribs. They weren't, you know, harmless pranks or whatever.
Oh,
with,
no.
You know, a bucket of confetti would fall on your head or something.
Do you have the version of the Jay York story?
Yeah, I heard Piper talking about that on YouTube, about filling Jay York's car full of ice and then filling his inhaler full of lighter fluid.
Yeah, that was the one I knew.
That could kill you, for real.
Yes, it could. So that's the kind of really sadistic ribs. And Johnny, unfortunately, at the end, I mean, not a lot of people came out for him when he'd passed.
Yeah.
So, I mean, which is a shame.
He'd been out of the spotlight for a long time, too, by then.
And he burned a lot of bridges, I think, didn't he?
Probably so, yeah.
He was kind of... I always kind of thought of a modern-day equivalent to him more of like a – well, not exactly modern anymore, but a Bruiser Brody, a really kind of independent spirits, which is why he was never a world champion.
Right. Yeah. That's probably a good reason why he didn't take any crap from anybody, promoters, or any – probably burned a lot of bridges like Brody did. Although he wrestled in St. Louis a lot, and I think Sam Muchnick probably liked him and had a lot of respect for Johnny, so – But anybody wants to see him and Wahoo, there's a great 10-minute clip on the on YouTube. You can go look, and it's from 1974, and they just beat the crap out of each other for 10 minutes in that.
Is that from Jim Cornette's footage that he rescued from TBS?
Yes.
All right.
Did you get a copy of that?
Oh, yeah. I had that stuff back in the 80s. I still have it.
I got
I haven't watched it in a while.
I got one of the 10 original copies of it when he sold 10 copies when he first got it to defray the cost of making it. And I got one of those 10. So that's one of my prize collection. Prize things in my collection. Yeah.
You know, not to get off the Johnny Valentine subject, but the thing that really hit me when I first saw those tapes, I mean, you know, I grew up in the Northeast. I went to the Boston Garden. The Boston Garden could be pretty crazy sometimes. I've been to Madison Square Garden. They have enthusiastic fans. But those fans in the Carolinas, my God, they were loud and they were into it, man.
Oh, for sure. For sure.
I mean, there's a match on that. It's Blackjack Mulligan against Baron Von Raschke. I'll never forget this. They spent like 5 minutes doing a spot where they're trying to each to put the claw hold on each other and not succeeding, and the other guy is fending the other guy off.
Right.
And nothing is happening, but it doesn't matter. The place is heated enough to melt butter.
Oh, for sure. That the crowds were really into it back in the 70s when those tapes were made. Just some great, you know, a lot of flair, and Greg Valentine versus Ole and Gene Anderson on those tapes too. So,
Kinds of good stuff. There's Orndorff and Snuka teaming up, and you can order it. If you go to jimcornette.com,
yeah, he's got
a link where you can pick him up.
Yeah. $100 for 18 2-hour DVDs of top quality of, you know, the originals of those that are on YouTube now, or the ones on there now, are copies of copies of copies, but he's got the originals you can buy, copy up.
Yeah, that's less than $3 an hour for some serious action.
And yeah, if you only know Paul Jones as the cowboy hat wearing manager with the whip, then you should check these out. You'll get a different perspective on Paul.
Yeah, he
absolutely.
He and Johnny Valentine had a huge feud on TV here too.
Was he before Wahoo or after?
Before.
So he was the first feud with John. What was it like when Johnny
The first feud was Bearcat Wright. They feuded forever.
Oh, really? And, well, Bearcat's – he would have known Bearcat from Capitol, because they would have been in Washington and New York at the same time in the late 50s.
Yeah.
And Bearcat supposedly had one of the most violent matches ever. They caused this huge riot in New Jersey against Eddie Graham.
I'm sure.
But
what was the time frame on the Bearcat Wright feud?
It was like after he came in like late 73, I guess, into early 74.
Okay, and it's the Valentine who came in and Bearcat was already there?
I'm guessing Bearcat was already there, but like there were a lot of six-man tags with Johnny Valentine and Ole and Gene Anderson versus like Bearcat Wright and Bob Bruggers and people, and Sandy Scott and people like that.
Okay.
Before Valentine got there, that was a huge tag team territory, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. It was all tag team. When I moved here in 1971, there was pretty much strictly tag teams, like Rip Hawk, Sweet Hansen, Brute Bernard and the Missouri Mauler, George and Sandy Scott, Johnny Weaver and George Becker, Paul Jones and Nelson Royal. Those were like they were like the people in the territory then. And about the only single I remember is Abe Jacobs.
was Gene and Lars there then too?
Lars was in and out a few times, but
okay.
He wasn't ever around very much that I can recall, because and in fact, I went to a TV taping in outside of Charlotte one time, and David Crockett before the taping was it was in like a high school gymnasium, and he was taking answers, and somebody asked him, when is Lars Anderson coming back? And he said, that nut job ain't never coming back here.
Oh, wow. That's great.
Yeah. It was pretty funny, I thought.
How was Johnny introduced to the area?
Well, there's a clip of it on YouTube of him. David Crockett introduces him and says, he's a very somber. It's like 2 minutes long, but David Crockett's there and says, a world-famous wrestler, Johnny Valentine, is coming into our territory after traveling around the world and competing all over the world and very successfully. And then Valentine talks. He's real serious. He's wearing a coat. He doesn't have a tie on, but he's wearing a sports coat and dressed up. And he says he's there for the competition and the money, and he will show everybody that his reputation is well earned. And it's a very cool clip if you hadn't seen it. It's like a minute 48 seconds long. So it's when he was introduced.
I have seen it.
What did you think of Johnny as a promo?
He wasn't the most exciting one, but his gimmick was being tough, and he certainly projected that for sure.
I always kind of felt like Ronnie Garvin was a similar kind of style.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah.
So now, what was he? When did you? You had mentioned before that you saw him in Florida. When was that?
That was like, I'm thinking like 71, maybe 72.
Okay.
Somewhere in there. Cause I remember he wrestled for sure. I know I saw him wrestle, cause they would play clips from the arenas a lot. You know, I think he wrestled Paul Jones down there, and I think he wrestled, I know he wrestled Tim Woods down there.
I heard a story. I think Mike Graham told the story on one of the podcasts that he had a feud with Red Bastien a couple of years earlier. Mm-hmm. And someone had seen Red and Johnny barbecuing at the beach, and the fan, whatever, told Eddie, and Eddie called the both up. He goes, "This happened?" He's like, "Yeah." He goes, "You're out of here."
Very well could be, because Eddie was a stickler, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I mean, you had to be back then.
Yeah.
And I mean, talking about that, can you guys – I wish I'd looked this up before the show. Who exactly was in the plane with Johnny when he had that plane crash that ended his career?
It was Ric Flair, David Crockett, Bob Bruggers, Tim Woods, Johnny Valentine, and the pilot.
Okay.
And the pilot
died.
And
there's a story. And it's one of my favorite wrestling stories out there. And it goes to show – how much these guys, how far they are willing to go to protect the business back then. And this
Tim Woods story
shed a lot of light.
Tim Woods.
I actually talked to Tim Woods about that.
Okay, you know what? Then I'm going to say something really quick and hand the ball off to you. I mean, I once had bruised ribs, and it was like the old joke, does it hurt? Only when I breathe. And they were bruised, not broken.
You can't do anything. Everything hurts.
Right.
Yeah. Tell us about your conversation with Tim Woods about the plane crash.
Very quickly. After I graduated from college in 1977, I moved to Charlotte and lived there for 5 years. And I had taken a job and I hated it and quit after a couple of weeks. And I just looking for something to do, I started selling stereo equipment. I worked at a store that sold TV, stereos, video recorders, all that kind of stuff for 5 years. And it was a great job, a lot of fun. And since it was in Charlotte, a lot of wrestlers would come in and all. Well, one of them was Tim Woods, and I recognized him. We started talking, and he actually came in 3 or 4 times. And, you know, when he was in Charlotte, he lived in Columbia, South Carolina at that time, but he would come by and shoot the shit. And we were talking about the plane crash, and he, there was a story going around that Ric Flair was sitting up in the seat by the pilot, and that, he was complaining about not wanting to be up there. He wanted to be in the back. And Valentine said, "Shut the hell up and swap with me." So Valentine got the front seat, and that's why he was hurt so bad his career ended. So I was asking I asked Tim Woods if that was true. And he said, "Well, they did switch seats. I don't know if it was because he was, you know," he said, "I don't want to say that Rick was complaining and whining, but they did switch seats. And that's why Johnny was hurt so much worse than anybody else, because he was up in the front with the pilot." And then I said, "And y'all weren't supposed to be traveling together since y'all were feuding at the time." He said, "Right." So he said, "I had to." And then when it was in the papers about who all was in the plane crash, it said Tim Wooden, W-H-O-D-I-N, which was his real name. And he said, "So I had to come out within 2 weeks because everybody was thinking, you know, Tim Woods, Mr. Wrestling, was on the plane with Johnny Valentine. So I had to go in, even though I was hurt like hell, and wrestle to prove that I was not in that plane." So he did do that. It was a true story. And he said it was horrible. And supposedly Ric Flair said that, you know, Tim Woods saved wrestling in the Carolinas by doing that.
I believe it. I mean, that was just the way it was back in the day. But I can imagine doing something with broken ribs. Like I could barely move with bruised ribs when I had them.
Never mind the injury. He was in a plane crash. I'd still be under my bed 2 weeks later.
Same here.
I mean, Bob Bruggers never wrestled again. You know, Johnny Valentine he barely walked after that. And the pilot went into he was in a coma and never woke up from it.
And they told Rick he was never going to wrestle either.
Exactly.
Rick said something about the pilot was negligent. Do you guys remember the details on this?
Ran out of gas. Well, what happened was he didn't distribute the weight of the wrestlers in the plane correctly, and it was kind of flying off. It was the weight was imbalanced, and so he jettisoned a lot of the fuel on the way, because they were all big guys and it wasn't that big of a plane. So he jettisoned all the fuel out so that not all of it, but he thought he had enough to get there. They ran out of gas is what happened.
Oh, man. So, and I can only imagine what it would be like to be in a plane that's out of gas.
Exactly. Another funny story is that Jimmy Crockett was supposed to be on there, Jim Jr., and he got sick with the flu, and he asked David to take his place, and David did. So that's why he was on the plane.
Oh, man. Jim Crockett Jr. had gone down in that plane crash, it would have had a butterfly effect that would have completely changed wrestling history.
You're right.
It's like the Waylon Jennings thing.
Buddy Holly.
Yeah.
Yep. For sure.
Wow. So anyway, back to Johnny Valentine. Have you heard – I heard about the J. York rib. I never heard about Johnny filling his car up with ice. That's kind of funny.
So supposedly that's how it started. They were in Calgary, and J. York had bought a brand-new Cadillac, and they were at a party at this house, and Johnny went outside and took a water hose and put it inside the car and filled the car up, and it – overnight, J. York came out the next day. It was full of ice. So then they were in another town together, and J. York paid him back by getting a welding iron and welded a bunch of shit to Johnny Valentine's car and messed his car up. And so then the next time they were together is when he did the lighter fluid in his asthma inhaler.
And I heard J. York went after him with a gun.
Well, he did. But it was a fake gun. This was a rib they pulled on the other guys in the locker room.
It was all forgiven, and now they're tag teaming and putting ribs together on other people.
Yeah, he pulls a gun out and he says, "I'm gonna kill you, MF-er," and shoots him. And he had a blank in there, and Valentine had a ketchup pack under his shirt, and he hit his chest, and there looked like there was blood all over his shirt, and he fell down. And then all of a sudden, he does an Undertaker sit up, and they start laughing, and. But Harley Race was in there, and he had a gun in his bag. When he saw J. York with a gun and heard the shot, he pulls his gun out and says, "Jay, put your gun down. Put your gun down now." And then all of a sudden, Valentine sits up, and they start laughing. So,
ladies and gentlemen, the wrestling business in the 70s, it was a bit out of hand. I think these are just only examples of some of the stuff that went on with these dudes.
Random Johnny Valentine story just popped into my head. It was in I think Luthez had it in his book, but he may have been in Saint. I can't remember where the town was. Lou's about to text me what it is in about 5 seconds. But he was in Saint Louis or some town, and Lou got pulled over, and Lou steps out of the car, and there was like some kind of an argument or something like that, and one of the other police officers started laughing. And he goes, "What's so funny?" He goes, "Do you remember the big blonde guy who beat up like five of you guys? Yeah, he just pinned him tonight. So if he did that to you guys, I can't wait to see what he does. This guy does."
That's funny.
So, I mean, Lou was obviously a huge fan. He would always put Johnny over. But now I'm going to obsess a little bit because, again, we have somebody here. We're seeing Wahoo and Johnny live. How was the feud introduced in North Carolina? Now, this is a feud that was in where? It was in Houston. It was in Florida. It originated in Florida, I think, in like 68, 69.
Probably so, yeah.
And it went off to Houston. Where else did it go? Did it go anywhere else?
No telling. I have no idea. And I don't even know. I don't even remember right now how it was introduced in the Carolinas. But I just know that I saw him on TV. Doing interviews together, and I saw they were coming to Dorton Arena, and I drove over from Chapel Hill to Johnny was in here in the Carolinas when I was in college, so I wasn't as into wrestling as I was before college or after college, but I did watch it when I could, and I went to some matches, but not near as much as I did before or after. But I did want to definitely go see the two of them wrestle, and I think the match I saw, I'm pretty sure Johnny Valentine won by DQ that night.
Actually, tell me, do you mind telling us about that night, the match? I'm just fascinated by these two.
Well, they did a lot of chopping and beating each other up, and it was just a very violent, all aggression match, and they milked the crowd for everything it was worth. And go watch that. There's a clip of the two of them fighting. Like I said, on YouTube, it's 10 minutes long, and that's pretty much what you would see. What I can remember from seeing that match. You know, it's 75, so we're talking. What, 20, you know, almost 40 years ago, 35 years ago, 40 years ago.
Even longer than that, we're looking at almost 50, like 45 years.
Yeah,
and, like,
45.
Let me ask you this. This isn't like a Johnny Valentine question, but this kind of stuff fascinates me. In your own words, try to tell us what it was like to be a wrestling fan growing up in the Carolinas in the early 70s. Like, was it all over the place? Did you know, when you went to school, did people talk about it? Like,
not very much. In fact, it wasn't that big, at least in the high school I went to. I mentioned going to see Dory Funk Jr. and Jack Briscoe wrestle in September 1972 here at Dorton Arena. And the semi-main event was Eddie and Mike Graham versus Bobby Shane and Rock Hunter. And a friend of mine went with me. It was September of my senior year in high school. We just started. And he said, man, I hope we don't run anybody out. We know. And I said, why? He said, I just don't want anybody to know I came to this. And I said, well, tell them we saw Funk on the marquee and thought it was Grand Funk Railroad. He thought that was funny. So,
It was like that for me too. I mean, yeah. If I was going to go out and buy my stack of wrestling magazines, you see, here's the thing. I always felt like when I was a kid, I felt like it's okay to watch it on TV. It's okay maybe every now and then to go to Jack Witchie's and play it off like, you know, oh, I like it, but it's not a big deal. But like if you're buying magazines, you've crossed the line.
Right.
And I would take my bike to the next town over and buy the magazines and make sure they were in a brown paper bag. And I went by myself.
Right. But once I got into college, I found a few more people that liked it. And, you know, it wasn't as hard to find some, you know, people to go, like, go to the TV tape-ins or go to but it wasn't until, like, the mid to latter part of the 80s that it got to be really popular, it seemed like.
Yeah, I remember reading that the first time Greensboro sold out was Christmas night, 78, when they had Blackjack and Flair and Steamboat and Jones, which were both, like, hot feuds involving turns.
Right. Yeah, that's probably right. And I know that match with Funk and Briscoe here was not a sellout. I mean, it was pretty crowded, but it wasn't a sellout. And the Valentine Wahoo wasn't a sellout. But, I mean, Dorton Arena didn't hold but about 6,500, I guess, for wrestling.
Yeah, that's one of my pet peeves as far as not only in wrestling but in all sports. Like, just because something isn't a sellout, it doesn't mean it wasn't a success.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, if you know, I'm sorry, the Cleveland Indians can only draw 30,000 on a Tuesday night in May, and they didn't sell out. Oh, what a shame! But you know, that's like I said, pet peeve of mine. So anyway, I mean, as far as like house shows and stuff go, were there a lot available like in the area? Like, you know,
yeah, they were running two in the 70s. They were running two shows a night.
Okay, and it's not that big a geographical area.
Well, they were running North Carolina, South Carolina, and Virginia, so that's a pretty good it's not small by any means. From one end of North Carolina to the other, it's wide. It's like an 8-hour drive. So.
Yeah, that's true.
This is also the reason they had the various belts in that region, right? Because you'd be able to have a belt defense in each town. Since you've watched it back then, this kind of always I'm curious about this. When did you realize Ric Flair was a big deal or was going to be a big deal?
Pretty soon after he got there. I mean, when Rip Hawk introduced him as his cousin or nephew or whatever and started grooming him, you could tell he had a lot on the ball. And then he just blew way the hell up. It was unreal how popular he was, even as a heel he was.
And this is with the tie-dye outfit at this point.
Oh yeah, I mean, yeah.
Did how was his wrestling style different before the accident, or was it?
It wasn't a lot of different, but he probably used a few more power moves back then before the accident. You know, because he was at one time he was really heavy. He was like 275, 280 or something, and he was really bulked up. So, I don't think he's quite as big after the accident.
No, yeah, he slimmed way down after the accident.
Yeah, because he was even heavier than that in the AWA. He was over like 300, wasn't he?
Probably close to it. Yeah.
Yeah. So it sounded like he kind of really just picked it up really quick right away. Because I remember hearing a couple of promos on the Mid-Atlantic Gateway site from Wahoo and Rick, which mm-hmm. is a great, great feud. And he just had this kind of really – I even liked the promos back then better than the ones I like later on because they just had kind of a – it was almost a raw emotion to it where he's snarling at Wahoo. He says, I'm going to drop you so far down the well that you're going to be hearing your voice echo up. And it's just – there's just like something building to – I don't know. It's something kind of – it seemed more programmed – later than when you hear the early stuff. The early stuff just is, you know, even crazier energy.
Absolutely. And even though he was a heel, people loved him there.
Well, that's pretty much why you had to turn him face, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I would see him in a nightclub and people were just mobbing him. I mean, not like they would a heel or anything, but he and Blackjack were always mobbed, even no matter if they were baby faces or heels, people just loved them.
It must have been great to have to be a baby face against Rick.
Exactly. And I was in this club one time in Charlotte when I lived there, and the two of them were there. Wahoo was in there, and somebody took a swing at Wahoo, and he just beat the crap out of him in there. In the club, this was in the 70s. This was probably – that was probably 79 or 80, maybe.
Who brought
that
the bright
– bad, bad move.
Exactly. Who brought the bright boy? Oh, my – God. Did you ever get the chance to see Flair and Ricky?
Absolutely.
Your early days?
Absolutely.
How I've heard that the matches in the 70s, as great as the matches in the late 80s were, the matches in the 70s were way better.
I wouldn't say they were way better, but you know, they were as good, I would say. And the ones in the 80s were awesome.
I've made the argument with John here that my issue with Ricky in the 80s was the fact that his character was it just wasn't compelling I was trying to go away from that, but yeah, it's pretty much the truth, and much different than he was in the 70s.
Right, you're absolutely right about that,
because he was kind of the swinging batch a little bit.
Right.
Ricky in the 70s, oh yeah.
Even with the mustache and everything like that.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, Mike, let me ask you this. You lived in the Carolinas when the plane crash happened.
Yes.
Can you start by telling me like what the coverage was like of the general event?
Before you say that, could you just tell me what your initial reaction was when you heard?
I went, holy shit. You know, you were thinking a plane crash. They were very lucky they all weren't killed.
Yeah.
And and just the same thing with Buddy Colt and Gary Hart and those guys in Florida. They were all lucky that, you know, they weren't killed along with Bobby Shane when they crashed. But they crashed in the water, where this plane crash was not in the water. It was on the land. And, it was on the TV. It was in the newspapers. It was, you know, it was a big deal.
Okay, which so is it was a big one story time, down there.
Yeah. Which is a one-time story, or was it something they continuously covered?
It was, you know, it didn't go on and on and on, but it was pretty big for, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 days at least, maybe a week.
Now, what was the initial reaction as far as, you know, sticking with Johnny Valentine, and then we'll go with Ric Flair too. I mean, Valentine, was he still a heel at the time?
Yeah. Yeah. He was feuding Tim Woods.
No, that's right. We already talked about that.
He was always heel, right? In
pretty much,
Carolina?
Yeah.
So what was the reaction, even though they were heels, to the reports that both Johnny Valentine and Ric Flair had suffered serious injuries in this plane accident?
Well, I mean, they were both respected as athletes, and so you know, people hated that they were hurt. And I mean, one, like, people didn't celebrate, like, you know, so when the promoter Paul Jones died, everybody cheered because they thought it was the wrestler Paul Jones. It wasn't like that at all.
You took the words out of my mouth. I was going to use that exact example. That's pretty sick. Okay, and now, how did everyone find out, well, that Johnny Valentine, just, he was done. He was never going to wrestle again. Like, did that ever kind of become official?
Well, I'm pretty sure, I can't remember exactly how it got out or how I heard about it, but they may have said it on TV or something after a while, or, you know, when they gave an update. I just don't remember that part, John.
No, that's perfectly understandable. I can't tell you the exact moment I figured out that Magnum TA was never going to wrestle again, but it sunk in eventually. I remember Jim Crockett getting on TV and saying, you know, hey, Magnum's not going to be wrestling for a long time.
His wreck was much bigger news than the plane crash here in the Carolinas.
I think that makes sense because it was almost like the wrestling itself seemed bigger in the 80s than it did in the 70s, like,
right,
in general.
Right, right, for sure.
I just thought of something that I never quite dawned on me before. How Rick came back as a heel, right?
Mm-hmm.
How is that possible?
He could make himself heel.
Oh, I
yeah, you would have thought they would have turned him, but I guess he wanted to get back into it. He was always more comfortable as a heel, and he probably just wanted to get back in the swing of things. And,
was there a tendency to?
I mean, he got cheered a lot as a heel, even.
That surprises me, and I'll tell you why. I have heard from people who went to shows in, like, Mid-South wrestling saying, you better not cheer the heels down there, or, you know, someone will beat you up. I remember, you know, going to Boston Garden and getting into, not fights, but, you know, arguments about, you know, because me and my friends cheered the heels, we didn't care, and, you know, we'd have a confrontation or two. And it just seems to me like North Carolina would be, you know, even more heated as far as the heat.
It wasn't, you know, everybody in the crowd cheering him, but there was, you know, he got his share of cheers, you know, especially when he would do the woo.
You know, it's funny because you would watch stuff from Madison Square Garden from, like, let's say 80, 81, and they would have a battle royal and the guys would get introduced. It was almost like Pavlovian, like the heels got booed and the baby faces got cheered. Right. And I mean, was it more like that with, like, Ric Flair, you know, getting, I don't know, 15% of the fans as an exception, or was it like split 50-50 more?
I'd say he got at least 25%, at least, maybe a little more. And then, you know,
wow.
Yeah. I mean, he did some, you know, he did some dastardly things to try to get, you know, people to hate him, and a large majority did, but there's still some that didn't, for sure.
Yeah, you had mentioned that Rick was more comfortable in the heel role, which, I mean, I know he was. I mean, there was no reason why he ever should have been turned again in 1990, but Rick was the booker and he wanted to do it. Have you heard anything as far as, like, the timing of his turn in 1979? Like, you know, was Rick resistant of it or anything like that?
I think they were starting to build toward him, you know, becoming a NWA title holder, and they wanted to get him some experience doing that, being a babyface. So I think that's probably why.
That makes a lot of sense. But when it happened, I mean, in hindsight, obviously, I was shocked when I got the magazine and it said, you know, Ric Flair is now a good guy in the Carolinas. Right. But in hindsight, it was time, I thought.
And he was still, even though he was a babyface in the Carolinas, he was still a heel other places. Like, I remember when he won the title from the first time from Dusty in 81. Gordon Soley came on the Georgia Championship Wrestling and said, The dastardly Ric Flair defeated Dusty Rhodes for the NWA Championship last night or this week.
Dastardly, wow.
Or something like that, you know. Yeah, I think he might have even said dastardly. But he did. He did. You know, he said.
Unlike Gordon, but yeah, I mean, and I saw. I mean, I know Rick had been in Florida pretty regularly. He was at least known in Georgia, but before he got the title, I mean, obviously the Carolinas was his backyard.
For sure, absolutely. In fact, I actually, the Charlotte paper had a little story in there about him winning the title from in 81. So,
oh wow.
Yeah,
wrestling after never got coverage like that in the newspapers out here, and I do mean never.
That was one. Well, Charlotte had it. The Charlotte paper, the Raleigh papers, never had results. And when I grew up in Alabama, we got the Montgomery papers and the Birmingham papers. There wasn't any wrestling in Montgomery at the time when I grew up, but Birmingham they had matches every Monday night, and they would always Tuesday would be in the afternoon paper results. Even though I didn't ever see those guys on TV, I followed them in the paper, like Lynn. And Ross and all those guys.
Oh, I get that. I mean, outside of WWF, I followed everything in the magazines for the longest time. And yeah, you would have a show at the Boston Garden that would sell out. And Monday morning in the Boston Globe, there would be a little thing with the results. And it was about the size of 4 postage stamps.
Right.
It was that small.
Yeah.
Same thing with the New York papers.
Right.
So let me ask you this. Supposedly there was a plan in place where Johnny Valentine was going to be turned eventually and was going to be the top babyface in the Mid-Atlantic area. How do you think that would have worked, or do you think it would have worked?
I'm sure it would have. You know, the bigger the heel, the bigger they can be a face once they turn, if it's done right. And I'm sure
almost
it would
have been universally.
Yep. For sure. For sure.
My only concern would have been Johnny's age. Do you remember exactly how old he was when the plane crashed? I want to say 45. I think he was older than that. I think he was like 48.
Well, let's see. He was born in 28. So, he was 47 when the plane crashed.
Yeah, because – okay, so if he was born in 28 – wow, he would have been in his 50s, you're close to his 50s, in the mid-70s and late 70s, he would have been older than 50, obviously. And I mean, even in, I know wrestling, you always had old guys. I mean, it wasn't like baseball, football, where 30 is old. You know, 30, you're kind of just getting started in wrestling, but I think 50 would have been tough for anybody.
Right.
So let me ask you this. You started wrestling. You started watching wrestling. You first got cable February of 69. But when did you start watching wrestling in Alabama?
Okay. Well, I absolutely clearly remember something that happened in August of 83. I mean, August of 63 on the TV. So I obviously started watching it before then. But the family that owned the promotion, Lee Fields and his brothers owned the promotion, but nobody knew it. But they were the big stars in Alabama, and Bobby Dunn and Lee Fields. And I remember very clearly them coming on TV and saying Don Fields was involved in a very serious car wreck and would have to retire from wrestling. And looking back, and I looked it up on the internet, and that happened in August of 63. So that's the earliest I can remember. But I know I watched it before then, because I saw him wrestle on TV.
Wow. So you go, well, you started watching it at a way younger age than I did. I started watching seriously when I was like 10 years old. I got hooked.
Right. Well,
this was 75.
Yeah. That's probably 7 or 8 when I started watching. I'm, you know, 7 probably. And our town was like an hour due west of Dothan. And they did TV in the Saturday mornings. And they ran Houston County Fire Center Friday nights. They did TV on Saturday mornings in Dothan, and every 2-3 weeks they would run a spot show at the National Guard Armory in our town on Saturday night.
And you told me you didn't start going to the matches until you were a senior in high school.
Well, that was the one. I went to a few in Alabama, so I probably went to 3 or 4 or 5 in Alabama, but I didn't go regularly because my parents didn't want me to.
I know that feeling.
Hey, but since I know we're probably running out of time in this, the thing about Johnny Valentine, you know, he did this huge feud with Paul Jones in the Carolinas, and he would come out on the TV station with a fishbowl with $1,000 in it. Do you know about that story?
Yeah.
Johnny Valentine, he would come out there with his fishbowl and said anybody that could beat him in 10 minutes, he would give him $1,000. And so he wrestled a bunch of people on TV and a few times he did on house shows, and he never lost. And then Paul Jones kept coming out there and wanting to wrestle for it, and he would never wrestle him for it. So then Jones came out with a fishbowl of his own with $1,000 and said he would put up $1,000 against Valentine's $1,000. Would Valentine wrestle in them? So Valentine said, hell yeah, I'll wrestle you if you're putting up $1,000. And Valentine won, so then he had $2,000. That was on TV.
What? I love that because it's just such an old-fashioned wrestling angle, you know, that the heel is putting up a prize. Well, the babyface is also putting up a prize.
Right.
So
there's a good story on the Mid-Atlantic Gateway about that. Tell all about it. It was in some audio clips of them talking about it too. So,
well, you know what? I mean, we've still got another like good 15 minutes.
Oh, okay.
Do you have any cool random Johnny Valentine story like that one? By the way, I've got a cool Mike Gunner story before we go.
Now I'm curious.
No, nothing wrong, nothing bad.
Well, I heard that. Well, this is kind of dirty, so you might not want to. But about Johnny Valentine, like to.
Yeah.
Supposedly he would squat down and take a dump in guys' bags in the locker room all the time, and that was one of his favorite ribs to do.
Yeah, Johnny would also put that substance in people's food. It seemed like he had a little bit of a fetish with that.
Right.
But I mean, if I want, I have a cool Johnny Valentine story, and tell me if you're familiar with this. I guess early in his career, he took a booking in Argentina, and somehow the booking fell through, the promoter disappeared, and this guy is stuck in like the bottom part. Johnny Valentine is stuck in the bottom part of South America without enough money to get home. And he wrestled his way all the way through South America, through Central America. Every time he worked a match, he'd just take the money and get enough money to go as far north as he could, and that's how he got home.
Well, I never heard that, but it's probably right, for sure.
I think I read it in the Observer, and I might have a detail or two off, but I definitely heard that story, and I can only imagine it being, you know, late 50s, early 60s, you know, totally different world, no way to get in touch with anyone to get some money in your hand, and you've got to travel, oh, I don't know, 7,000 or 8,000 miles to get home.
Right. Yeah, it makes sense.
So do you remember any other angles that he was involved in?
No, not really. That Silver Dollar one was probably the biggest thing, other than the him and Wahoo. Although, you know, him beating Harley Race for the U.S. Heavyweight Championship in the Greensboro Coliseum was a big deal. They had a tournament. Harley had won a tournament, and then he defended it, and Johnny beat him, and that was a big deal at the time. And then he gave up the Mid-Atlantic Championship that he had won from I think he won it from Sonny King, and
that sounds right.
He won it from Sonny King like in November of 74, and then in July he beat Harley for the U.S. Championship on July 4th, I think, 75. So I think that's right.
Okay, that sounds about right. Let me ask you this. Do you remember how the Wahoo McDaniel versus Johnny Valentine feud got started in the Carolinas?
Off the top of my head, I really don't, John. Like I said, that was during my college days, and I kind of took a little hiatus from being so into the wrestling, but I just remember seeing them arguing on TV one day, and I said, holy shit, that should be good. And I watched the interviews and saw some, and decided to go see them in person.
Were you a little off topic, but I just kind of done on. Were you ever a denizen of the Section D?
Oh, I knew those guys. I mean, I met them, and I'm good friends with all those guys, and hung out with them a lot. So after, I mean, I actually lived in Greensboro for a few years, and hung out with those guys a lot. So I know them very well. And after a while, I mean, I went to a lot of cards in Greensboro Coliseum before I knew them, and so I probably didn't meet them until the late '80s. But after that, I hung out with them a lot.
How did the wrestlers respond to them? Because that was different. They would openly cheer for Flair, for the Horsemen. They would dress up like J.J. Dillon.
Sitting with them one time, I made Lady Blossom cry when she was, you know, Steve Austin's ballet by holding up some $1 bills and said, table dance, table dance. And she started crying. She got pissed.
Everybody said it was a...
This was the girl before Jeannie Clark, right?
Right.
Okay.
I've heard it was a constant battle between those guys and Doug Dillinger and David Crockett about getting the signs in and into the arenas.
Yeah, David Crockett. I got Jack Briscoe in some trouble with David Crockett in Charlotte one time in about this is probably 81 or 82 when he and Jerry were still baby faces. David Crockett didn't like them or me for sure.
He seems like a temperamental guy.
Do what, John?
I said he seems to frustrate a lot of people, David Crockett.
Sure, absolutely.
No, my John Hitchcock story, I met him when we were both in Baltimore for the 1991 Great American Bash. Mike, you were there too. This is when Ric Flair had just been fired, I want to say like 10 or 11 days ago. And we were all at the arena. The mood at the Baltimore arena was just dark. Everyone was pissed off that Flair got fired.
Is this the one with the Burger King crown? Is that the bash?
No, that was 89.
Okay.
that was ridiculous too. But John Hitchcock has this giant sign that says, "We have heard enough, H-E-R-D."
Right, right. I remember that.
But he's like way off camera. I am in the third row of the hard camera. So towards the end of the event, I run up to John and I'm like, "Look, I am right on camera. Can I have that sign?" And he gives me the sign. And I go over it. And like I said, it's towards the end of the event because I'm confident I'm going to get kicked out for doing this. And every time they had a video screen on the side, and every time they had the hard camera, I would put up the sign, "We have heard enough." Well, as soon as they saw the sign, they would switch camera angles. And I could see that they did that on the side camera. So I would put down the sign. Now they think, okay, well, he's put down the sign. Let's put the hard camera back on. And we're going back and forth doing this. And this is at the last match, I think, of the 91 bash, which was like Murdoch and Slater against somebody, who cares. But that is, if you want to go to WWE Network, you will see that bit of action there. Me having fun at the expense of the WCW camera crew.
That's funny.
And you were at the original Crockett Cup. Did you go to both shows?
Me? Yeah, I went to New Orleans. I went to the one in Baltimore and the one in Greenville and Charlotte. I mean, Greenville and Greensboro, yeah.
How was the first one? Because the original Crockett Cup was really kind of something different. They really did bring in teams from all over the world.
Absolutely. I thought it was a lot of fun. I had a good time. I went with a friend of mine from Raleigh. I had started talking to Dave Meltzer probably 6 months before that on the phone. And I knew he was going, and I was looking for him, but I never met up with him in New Orleans. But that afternoon, I was walking around, and Bill Watts is just standing over on the floor of the Superdome by himself. Nobody was even near him. And I went up to him, and I said, "Hey, Bill, have you seen Dave Meltzer? I'm looking for him." He just said, "I am too," and turned and walked off. But that's kind of funny. Anyway, it was a lot of fun. I enjoyed that a lot, seeing all those teams from all around. And it was the second one in Baltimore was a lot of fun. And then the third one's it's seen its better day by the time they had the one in Greensboro. I mean, yeah, Greensboro and Greenville.
Tell me some of your memories of the first one, because as you said, after, and there really wasn't any footage of the first one. That didn't really start until the second one.
Right. I was very disappointed. I was disappointed. I know they had to be with a crowd, especially in the afternoon. There wasn't hardly anybody there. But there were just so many teams there, and it was so much for one day. That's why they split it up into to two after that. But it was a lot of fun. There was a lot of people I'd never seen before. And, you know, I like seeing people I'd never seen wrestle before.
Who were some of the teams who were just coming? I remember they brought in the sheep herders for the occasion.
Well, let's see. Baba and Tiger Mask were there. Dino Bravo and Rick Martel, the Fabulous Ones, the Fantastics. Chavo and Hector Guerrero, Rock and Roll Express, Sheep Herders. I mean, Ivan and Nikita,
Road Warriors,
Midnights. Yep. I mean, they had a lot of good teams.
Now, the Road Warriors weren't in yet, were they?
At that time, I don't think so, no.
They had just come in.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well,
they came in like December 85.
Right. Okay.
Because so when was the Crockett Cup? So they would have, how long would they have been in?
It was April of 86.
Okay, so it would have been about a 5 month job. For some reason, I remember the Crockett Cup introduction being that they were coming in as part of the Crockett Cup. Just like I think the Sheep Herders stuck around for a little while too.
Yeah, I'm just looking right here. So the attendance in the afternoon was 3,500.
Ooh.
Do you think that was generous?
No, I would have thought it'd be a little bit more than the night. It says 13,000. So,
and the main event was Dickie Slater and Duggan, right?
Well, that was in Flair and Dusty.
That was the night show. What was the? Didn't they have another one for the afternoon show?
Oh yeah, that was Duggan and Flair. I mean Duggan and Slater. I'm sorry.
Yeah. So they had a bit of a Mid-South mix. So were both events in New Orleans, or?
Yeah, they're both in the Superdome.
Oh. Oh, 3,500 in the Superdome?
Mm-hmm. That's why Bill Watts wasn't looking too happy that when I saw him.
It must look like a convention.
But they're glad there wasn't footage of it.
Yeah.
So anyway, we are running out of time. Mike, before you go, thank you for coming on the show. We really appreciate it. But I remember this. I think it was the last time I saw you. We were in Baltimore. Actually, I've got two stories. We were in Baltimore for the 1991 Great American Bash. I think you were there for this.
Yes, absolutely.
It was. You were there, but I want to make sure you were here at this exact time. I was on an elevator with Wade Keller and a few other people, and we're on our way downstairs. And you got to remember, Wade Keller is from Minnesota.
Right.
Elevator door opens, and who do we see but Eric Bischoff? Were you there for this?
I don't think I was.
All right. So Eric is also from Minnesota.
Right.
And, of course, these guys are surprised to be running into each other in Baltimore. So they're cordial. They say hello. I don't say anything to Eric Bischoff because, you know, he at this point he was just the AWA announcer.
Right.
And that was our little, surprise. Eric Bischoff is one of the announcers now in WCW. Well, little did I know that was a day that was going to change wrestling for Eric forever, Eric getting his foot in the door.
Right.
And then, of course, later in the day, we're on the elevator and we get off and who's getting on but Harley Race. Right. And we're like, wow, they're bringing him in too. And he debuted that night. But, Mike, I definitely remember you were there for this. We were out roaming around in Baltimore. I think it was the night before the bash. And we're kind of wandering around. We're lost. We're looking for a strip joint, right? It was you, me, Wade Keller. Harry White was there. I think Ron Lemieux was there. I'm not sure.
Probably.
And we're walking in Baltimore, and it's the neighborhood is getting more and more dangerous.
Right.
Mike, do you remember this?
Yes.
And we're walking and we see railroad tracks. And as soon as someone saw those tracks, it's like, we're turning around. We're not trying to go this way anymore.
Right.
I always thought that was just so symbolic that we're not going on the wrong side of the tracks in Baltimore. But anyway, Mike, thank you again for being on. Sean, thank you for everything. And we'll be back next week. Thank everyone for listening. I want to thank Lou Kippelman, our awesome producer. And this has been a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. See you next week.